This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
On Sunday, March 2nd, 372 of us young people were arrested at the White House to demand leadership on climate.
This is not a Japanese nuclear accident. This is a nuclear accident that just happened to have occurred in Japan. It could very well have happened in the United States.
From the viewpoint of a nuclear expert, do you think American companies and governments could have done any better in the same situation?
No. I think had any of our reactors been faced with that kind of challenge, the outcome would have been the same.
Yes, despite a punishing cold winter, thousands of Americans showed up at the White House to fight off the Keystone XL pipeline. They were mostly young, protecting their future against climate change, and driven by the tar sands, the dirtiest fuel on Earth. I'll take you there. But first, on the third anniversary of the worst nuclear disaster in the world, I'll talk with the authors of Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. But as you heard, America is just waiting for its own nuclear mega-disaster. Despite promises after March 2011, the U.S. industry is still stalling on safety-critical fixes to aging reactors. It's just a matter of time. After the triple meltdown of reactors in Fukushima, Japan in March 2011, the American Nuclear Regulatory Commission did two things. They assured the public it can't happen here, and they promised a flurry of action to make reactors safer in the United States. Now we have the first new book from nuclear experts explaining what happened at Fukushima. And we have a report that nuclear reactors are still unsafe, maybe still waiting for the next major meltdown. Both come from David Lochbaum. He's worked in the U.S. reactors for 17 years. He was an instructor for the NRC. David is now director of the Nuclear Safety Project for the Union of Concerned Scientists. David Lochbaum, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex, for having me on again.
There's just so much to talk about. Before I get distracted by a long list of questions about American reactor safety, why don't we start with your new book as co-author of Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. How would you describe it to people?
We undertook the book with two purposes. One, to try to explain to a general audience what happened at Fukushima. It was a very gripping drama as the event unfolded, but it took some time for some of the government and other studies to try to go in there and figure out why things happened. So we tried to look at that record, do some research, and present what happened in a way that would be appealing to a broader audience than just the science folks out there. The second part of the reason for doing the book was to extract as many lessons learned from the disaster as possible so they can be implemented here in the United States to make it less likely that any of our reactors goes down that same pathway.
Has a book come out in Japan about this accident that you know about, and given the new secrecy laws, could it even come out?
Well, I know Arne Gunderson, a colleague of mine at Fairwinds, authored a book that was translated in Japan and came out about this time last year. So I know that book, they also made a tour through Japan a number of places to talk about the book. The word is getting out. It was a big disaster, and it's as relevant there as it is here.
Have you had any reaction from Japan about your new book?
Not so far. We've not yet had an edition translated into Japan. I have heard from some Japanese reporters who've read it. There's a few things they're still trying to track down. For example, there's a lot of rumors about the earthquake causing more damage than had the company or others are admitting. So there's some people want to track down some of those details yet.
Okay, well, to my mind, there are three major scenes in this Fukushima tragedy. The opening act is the decades where the risks could have been known and weren't dealt with. And then we have the technical story of what happened in nuclear terms. And maybe the saddest part, the failure of humans to react properly and rationally, which is maybe understandable. But let's start at the beginning. Should the Japanese have known this could happen, and could they have done more to prevent part of their country from being laced with radiation?
Well, the Japanese knew that that plant was in an area where the earthquake hazard was pretty high. They had designed the plant to withstand a 9.0 earthquake and kind of understood or recognized that an earthquake of even lesser magnitude than 9.0 could cause the plant to lose its normal supply of electricity, the off-site power grid. Recognizing that, they had designed the plant to have each of the reactors at Fukushima to have two emergency diesel generators at the site, only one of which needed to survive in order to provide power for the equipment needed to cool the reactor core. To better protect those emergency diesel generators from earthquakes, they put all of them down in the basement of the plants where they're best shielded or protected against ground motions caused by an earthquake. They also knew that because it was a coastal plant, that tsunamis could be a problem. They built a 15-foot tall seawall around the plant. As late as 2008, people had raised questions that given a 9.0 earthquake just offshore, that the tsunami wave height could be as high as 45 feet. Knowing that the seawall was only 15 feet tall and the hazard might be 45 feet tall, unfortunately, the company and the regulator said the chances of that occurring was so small as to not even worry about. On March 11, 2011, the tsunami wave that arrived was about 45 feet tall, proving the predictions right and proving the protections inadequate. The floodwaters got into the basement and caused all the emergency diesel generators to be disabled due to submergence. Had they fully recognized both the earthquake and the flooding hazards, they might have taken steps to employ diversity. Rather than put all the emergency diesel generators in the same place where they're best protected against earthquake but least protected against flooding, they might have put some up high and some down low, making it harder for the 1-2 punch to take everything off the table. So they had some opportunities, and they're actually taking those steps at the surviving plants now to build taller seawalls and implement some diversity, but it's a little bit too late for Fukushima.
Do we know where that nuclear fuel is now and what condition it's in?
No, we don't know where the three reactor cores are. Well, we have general proximity. They're somewhere inside containment, but we're not exactly sure whether the molten cores melted through the metal reactor vessels that surround them and got onto the containment floors. The Japanese have been trying to use remote indications to send in fiber optic cables. They've even floated remote-controlled boats on the water and even some remote-powered drones inside containment to try to get pictures of the situation in there. But so far, they've had various complications and still haven't yet found where the reactor cores ended up.
Is there any visible end to the process of trying to cool those reactors and handle all that radioactive water?
There is a visible end, but it's way, way down the road. It's probably 3-4 decades before they reach that destination. The good news is that they're making progress along that path. The bad news is it's a very long path, but they are making progress. To give them credit, things are much better off today than they were 2 or 3 years ago.
And they're starting to get the reactor fuel out of the fuel pool in Reactor 4. That's some good news to start with.
That's very good news. First of all, they went in 2011 and early 2012 and provided additional bracing for the building that housing the spent fuel pool that was damaged initially by the earthquake, then by the hydrogen explosion, and then by tons of water that were dumped from above. So they provided some concrete and iron bracing so that the additional aftershocks removing the fuel wouldn't cause the building to collapse. Then they moved out some heavy loads that were not radioactive, like the reactor vessel head and the drywall head, that demonstrated that they could lift heavy objects off of the floor and not cause collapse or further problems. Then they moved the new fuel that had not yet been irradiated, was not yet dangerous, out of the pool to again demonstrate that the process would work and build up confidence. And then last November, they began moving spent fuel out of the pool. So they're moving in an orderly, deliberate fashion to make things better without any backsteps or sidesteps.
Well, I'd like to see American reactor operators doing that all over the country, but we'll get to that. I know there's a problem with overloading of American fuel pools. Now, look, David, when we look at Japan as outsiders, it's very difficult to fathom what's going on there, even in normal times. From the viewpoint of a nuclear expert, do you think American companies and governments could have done any better in the same situation?
No. I think had any of our reactors been faced with that kind of challenge, the outcome would have been the same. The timeline might have been different. It might have taken a little bit shorter or a little bit longer at different places, or the pathway might have been a little bit different, but the destination would have been the same. The Fukushima plant technology was very similar to ours. And the regulations were, you know, a little bit better in some places, a little bit worse in some places, but not significantly different that would have caused our reactors to fare any differently. About the only difference between U.S. reactors and Japanese reactors was that we had done more after 9/11 to provide better protection against suicide aircraft than the Japanese had. Our plants had more portable pumps and more portable generators. But at the same token, we had added those resources with the suicide aircraft in mind. Much of that equipment was stored in buildings that wouldn't survive an earthquake or wouldn't survive a hurricane or some other natural disaster. So they would survive a suicide aircraft, but not acts of nature. So we, even though we were somewhat better prepared, we still have a way to go.
So you and the Union of Concerned Scientists just released a report on safety in nuclear reactors in America, and an amazing number of atomic power plants don't even meet the fire codes. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that all dates back to March 22, 1975, when a worker using a lit candle to check for air leaks started a fire in the room right below the control room for the Unit 1 and Unit 2 reactors at the Browns Ferry nuclear plant in Alabama. All the cables for the controlled equipment or powered equipment throughout the building went from the control room down through the floor and then radiated out through the plant through this room. The fire burned for 7 hours and basically disabled all of the controls and systems for cooling the Unit 1 reactor and the majority of those systems for the Unit 2 reactor. It was only some very heroic worker actions that day that prevented both reactors from melting down. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission in 1980 adopted regulations seeking to better manage the fire risk so that none of our reactors would come that close to, or worse, a problem in the future. In the mid-90s, the NRC found that most reactors did not meet those regulations, including the three reactors at Browns Ferry. So in 2004, the NRC adopted a second set of regulations. So now owners have choice of either meeting the 1980 regulations or meeting the 2004 regulations. But today, roughly half the plants in the country, it's like 49 out of the 100 reactors currently operating in the United States, don't meet either set of regulations. It's not an academic point. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission senior managers have testified to their commission that fire represents 50% of the threat of core damage at the typical U.S. nuclear power plant, which means it's equal to all the other hazards combined. The reason the hazard is so high is for the same reasons that Fukushima had problems. In that case, water flooded the systems, shorted out the electrical equipment, and prevented all the dozens of pumps from working. Fire poses the same threat. A single fire can disable primary safety systems and their backups, such that workers have no options left for preventing core damage.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking about the Fukushima nuclear accident and its lessons for safety in American nuclear plants. My guest is the author of a new book about it. David Lochbaum is with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Dave, in late June 2011, the Fort Calhoun nuclear reactor was surrounded by the floodwaters of the Missouri River. Why was that dangerous?
That was dangerous because the floodwaters could have caused the normal supply of power, the electrical transmission, the offsite power grid, power lines, everything, to fail. At the same time, it could flood the on-site backups, the emergency diesel generators, just as happened at Fukushima, where the earthquake and tsunami took out those two layers of power. Fort Calhoun was faced with a flooding that posed the same risk. The good news about Fort Calhoun was that the prior year, in the fall of 2010, the NRC's inspectors found that flood protection was not adequate at that plant. The owner protested, saying the plant had been operating for 30 years and therefore it must be good enough. But the NRC listened to those arguments and rejected them and made the owner take steps to better protect that plant against postulated flooding. Those measures came in real handy in June of 2011 when the plant literally became an island in the Missouri River. And while the plant was shut down for more than 2 years, things could have been much, much worse had not the NRC found and caused those problems to be fixed in advance.
And there's a bunch of other nuclear plants that have no plan to deal with the dam breaking upstream. Is that true?
That's true. In fact, there's 34 reactors that are like Fort Calhoun that are vulnerable to flooding. There's actually one plant in the country that's vulnerable to a downstream dam failing because that dam provides the lake from which it draws its cooling water. And if that dam were to fail, the lake becomes a mud flat and the plant doesn't have any cooling water supply anymore. So there are 35 reactors in the United States that are vulnerable to flooding, and the NOC's actually known about that since before Fukushima, since as early as 2007. But none of those plants are yet protected.
And this is something that puzzles me and it confuses the public. A nuclear reactor produces huge amounts of power, but if outside electricity is cut off, even for short periods, the whole system risks blowing up or melting down. Why can't a reactor use its own power to run the cooling system, the water intakes, and all that?
It could. Nuclear power plants could be self-powering, but in order to do that, the equipment used to make electricity and distribute it within a plant would have to be safety-related. It means it would have to survive the earthquake or the fire or whatever hazard it's faced. Nuclear power plants have highly reliable, high-quality equipment for cooling the reactor cores. They do not have that same equipment for making electricity. That's basically industrial grade. In order to upgrade the equipment to safety-related in the buildings that house it, since they could collapse in case of an earthquake, owners would have to spend much, much more money. So rather than do that, they don't rely on that equipment. They don't allow the plants, or they don't equip the plants to power themselves. Instead, they rely on two emergency diesel generators to provide the subset of equipment needed to cool the reactor cores. That philosophy works as long as the emergency diesel generators survive.
And they have battery backup for a few hours, 4 hours in some cases, and 8 hours in others. That seems so pitifully little. Why don't they get some batteries in there that could really keep it going until, as you put it, the cavalry can arrive?
That was based on looking backwards. We look backwards at how long power outages have lasted, either due to the grid or the emergency diesel generators. And it was generally thought that either 4 hours or 8 hours would be sufficient time to reconnect to the grid or fix the broken diesel generators and end the need to rely on the batteries. Part of it was also just short-sightedness, which in hindsight is hard to explain, but it happened anyway. Fukushima and our plants were all built under the assumption that an accident would only involve one reactor. Fukushima had six reactors sitting side by side by side, but it was only thought that one reactor would have a problem so that you could use the electricity generated from its neighbor to power the unit that was having an accident. You know, when you have an earthquake and tsunami that puts all six reactors in jeopardy, we had just never anticipated that. Neither the Japanese nor we had done that. In hindsight, again, that wasn't our brightest day, but that's the way it was.
Well, that sort of outlines another big problem with American nuclear power and nuclear power in general, that the licenses and oversight don't include the risks beyond a limited mode of thinking. Would you agree with that?
Yes, to an extent. We basically, in fact, our book talks about the X, we design for X, but nobody ever answers the question, what if X plus one occurs? And that speaks to that issue. Fukushima and our reactors are designed for only a certain range of hazard. We just don't anticipate anything larger than that will happen. If something larger does happen, we rely on miracles to occur, or we rely on we'll just get people out of the way. We'll evacuate or shelter people from the radioactive cloud so that no one will be harmed. Again, those emergency plans are predicated on the accident occurring on a nice sunny day where there's no damage to roads or any other problems getting people out of harm's way. I think Fukushima showed that everybody needs to do a better job of planning for the very severe accidents rather than just hoping they don't occur or that a miracle occurs to get them out of it.
On Radio EcoShock, I recently covered hearings where the NRC sought a generic environmental approval process for all nuclear reactors instead of case by case, and that followed a high court ruling, I believe. What happened to that?
That's still a work in progress. The ruling was what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission had ruled was that spent fuel generated by our plants could safely remain on site until a repository, geological repository, opened and was able to take that fuel. The court ruled that the NRC had not satisfied all the bases necessary for that decision. For one thing, it was open-ended. They didn't look, well, what if a repository is never available and so on. So the Nuclear Regulatory Commission undertook a proceeding to look at the issue from a generic standpoint, saying that all of our plants, all the spent fuel generated by our plants, could remain at the plant site for over a century after the plant shuts down and still be safe. That seems some more science fiction than science, but we'll let the courts decide.
And it seems like nuclear reactors almost never die in America. There have been some cases, but they're few. And no matter how old the concrete and the pipes, they seem to get an automatic license renewal, even for another 60 years beyond their design capabilities. Why is that happening?
Well, there have been some reactors that shut down. In 2013, four reactors in the United States shut down due to mainly economic reasons. But as you point out, more than three-quarters of the plants operating in the United States have sought and obtained license extensions. In some cases, to be fair to the NRC, they've ultimately said yes, but along the way they said no until the owner did more to satisfy the agency. So it's not quite a rubber stamp, although they've never denied one. They've said no, not yet, quite a bit. We've looked at license renewal or aging of nuclear power plants and compared it to two people who buy identical cars off the same lot on the same day. If the owner of the first vehicle doesn't change the oil, doesn't do any of the preventative maintenance that the owner's manual dictates, while the owner of the second car does all those preventative maintenance tasks, those two cars will likely be in different shapes down the road. The person who does the proper care will have a better car than the other owner. And we point out that U.S. nuclear plants are similar in that if you don't do maintenance properly, you can get in trouble well before your license extends or ends. And if you do the maintenance properly, you can also extend, ensure safety margins are maintained and allow your plant to operate longer. So we've been focusing on making sure that the safety margins are known and adequate rather than just look at the calendar and say some artificial date is the right answer.
David Lochbaum, getting back to your book, Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster, we learned the meltdown was made worse, likely by a flaw design in General Electric Mark I reactors. Tell us why that model could be more dangerous in an accident.
The containment that Fukushima had featured what is called a pressure suppression containment. In order to minimize the size of the containment and therefore reduce the cost for the amount of concrete needed to make the containment, that reactor design used a large body of water, more than 2 million gallons of water, housed inside containment. That water functioned essentially like an energy sponge to absorb the energy lost in case of an accident. The problem with that was that if the accident ever did occur and you weren't able to cool that body of water, because that energy sponge at some point becomes saturated and cannot absorb any more energy, they had no measure for cooling, emptying that energy sponge so it could absorb more energy. As a result, they tried to do some actions to get around that problem, but it meant sending workers into darkened areas that had 18 inches of water on the floor, open manholes, and high radiation levels. The workers weren't able to take the steps necessary to work around that problem in time to prevent three reactor cores from melting down. It wasn't that they failed. They were given so many traps that it was very unlikely they could succeed against those challenges. The system that they were given, which is the same as our plants are given, works if you have power. The most likely scenario for you to get into trouble is if you don't have power, and that's been recognized since the 1980s. So we've given people a solution that really no one expects to work, and yet we based operation on that myth.
How many of those Mark I reactors are still operating in the United States?
There are 23 that are very similar to the units 1, 2, and 3 at Fukushima. But to be fair to the General Electric and the owners of those plants, had any of the U.S. reactors of any design been faced with that challenge, they all would have melted down. So that design contributed to the outcome at Fukushima, but it wasn't the deciding factor.
All right. Now, after Fukushima, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission promised to be more vigilant and get more problems fixed in American reactors. Gregory Jasko was the NRC chair, and he wanted some changes, but then he was kind of booted out, it seems to me. What happened there, and is the NRC really fixed?
Chairman Jasko was very adamant about implementing the lessons learned from Fukushima, and things weren't happening as fast as he would have liked. His fellow commissioners were more accommodating or more leisurely in their pace of the reforms. That led to friction or added to friction that existed between them, and they basically voted him off the island, so he resigned. The NRC has ordered owners to take steps to reduce the vulnerabilities of their plants to the Fukushima-type challenges. Some of those orders have already been issued. There are some other recommendations that are still being evaluated for possible implementation. None of those recommendations is fully implemented at any site yet. The deadline was December 31st of 2016. in monitoring progress so far, 20% of the plants are behind schedule. So it's not boding well that they'll be done in time. It's in an odd situation. First of all, safety IOUs protect no one. It's only deeds that are done that provide protection. And the industry and the NRC are pretty much in a bad position. If an accident does occur that one of these IOUs would have avoided, they're basically be following the same path that Japan did. None of the reactors, nuclear reactors in Japan, are operating today because the civilians have lost trust in the companies and the government and do not allow the reactors to operate. So we're basically taking a huge gamble here, both with people's safety and politically, that an accident won't occur until we get all these fixes implemented.
Yeah, even with the economy. I mean, if 20% of America's power supply that comes from nuclear power was shut down by public demand or public fear, the economy, I don't think, could take the shock.
Yeah, but the flip side of that is the cost of Fukushima is estimated to be over $120 billion. So one bad day at a nuclear power plant can wipe out decades of good days. There's not many other technologies that have that risk-reward ratio.
True. Now, in testimony relating to the C10 group in Boston and the Pilgrim reactor relicensing, you explained that the NRC became much more lax about enforcing regulations after Congress threatened to cut that agency's funding. What is the status of that now?
That's pretty much still in place. That happened back on June 4th of 1998 when the Senate threatened to cut the NRC's budget by about $400 million, which would have, among other things, meant about 500 NRC employees would have been laid off. To avoid that slashing, the NRC agreed to stop enforcing its regulations, and that continues to this day. When Chairman Yatsko tried to enforce some of the safety regulations, they got rid of him rather than do that. So it's the NRC tries to regulate, and it did at Fort Calhoun. As I pointed out, in fall of 2002, it saw a problem and took steps to fix it, but they've been unable to enforce the fire protection regulations because the industry is just too much power. Congress has too much say over asking the NRC not to do its job.
Well, one wonders why Congress doesn't want to protect the American public from an obvious risk, and it comes back perhaps to campaign donations. Has anybody written a report or a book about the incestuous links between American political parties and nuclear industry donations?
A public citizen. Public Citizens Critical Mass Energy Project did studies like that as recently as 3-4 years. Actually, it was before Fukushima, so it would have been 4 or 5 years ago. And at that time, the nuclear industry ranked fourth on the list behind the American Medical Association, the AARP, and I forget who was third. I think it was the tobacco industry. But, the nuclear industry gives – they're quite liberal. They pay about equal amounts to Democrats and Republicans. It's not one-sided. They're largesse.
We'll buy everybody. You know, we have to wrap it up there, David. We're running out of time. Our guest has been David Lochbaum. He's worked in the American nuclear plants for 17 years. He's been an instructor at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Now David is director of the Nuclear Safety Project for an outfit I've been respecting for years, the Union of Concerned Scientists. David's new book is out. He's co-author with Susan Stranahan and a fellow UCS member, Edwin Lyman. And it's called Fukushima, the Story of a Nuclear Disaster. It's the first authoritative look at that disaster with lessons, and we all need to learn them. David, thank you for being so brave to speak out for all of our safety. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Alex, for having me on again. I appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Our next guest was the lead author of a team of reporters for the Philadelphia Inquirer. They're reporting on the Three Mile Island reactor accident in Pennsylvania on March 28, 1979, way back then, won a Pulitzer Prize. Susan has published in the Los Angeles Times, Washington Post, Fortune, Time Magazine, and Rolling Stone. She's now a freelance writer living in Maine. Susan Q. Stranahan is co-author of the new book, Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. Susan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex. Happy to be here.
Well, even though I followed nuclear affairs for too long, I don't want to admit how long, before Three Mile Island, I only learned after Fukushima that there really was a meltdown inside those reactors in Pennsylvania. Can you tell us about that?
Well, there was just the one reactor was affected by the accident, and yes, it was a partial meltdown, but I suppose a partial meltdown is like being partially pregnant. The sequence of events were so confusing initially, and it wasn't until considerably later when they were finally able to get in and examine the reactor to figure out how much damage that they discovered that, in fact, there had been a partial meltdown. So I'm sure that looking at Fukushima, there will be plenty of surprises of a similar or worse nature once they are able, assuming they are able, to get in and better calculate the extent of damage there.
Right. It wasn't until about 4 years later that they got cameras in at Three Mile Island. Is that right?
I think that's right. I'd have to go back and look at my notes. It has been a while.
Well, then it makes you wonder why it takes so long for this full story to come out. Even I didn't know it, and why most Americans still buy the original line that it was just a little release of radioactive steam that happened there in Three Mile Island.
I think part of it is that the public has a fairly short attention span, and so as details trickle out slowly, it's no longer on the front page. Some of the media in that part of Pennsylvania, of course, followed events very carefully. I mean, I was a member of the editorial board of the Inquirer during the 1980s, and a key issue was the restart of Unit 1. There was an enormous amount of opposition to that, believing that if they couldn't run Unit 2 safely, they couldn't be trusted to run Unit 1 safely. But the restart was eventually approved, and ironically, Unit 1 at Three Mile Island is the little engine that could. It's just a high-performing old reactor, but high-performing, a moneymaker for the owner, and there have been some safety issues there, but I think by and large the safety record is on average with other well-run reactors in the United States.
Who did own Three Mile Island?
Well, at the time of the accident, it was a very small local utility called Metropolitan Edison that had no nuclear operating experience, and it was a subsidiary of a larger utility called General Public Utilities that was based in New Jersey. But the Three Mile Island plant ended up on the Susquehanna River in central Pennsylvania, basically because there were some concerns about labor issues of building a reactor in New Jersey. So the Unit 2 reactor was built in Pennsylvania.
Why did you decide to help write the story of this triple meltdown in Fukushima, Japan, 3 years ago?
I have worked with Dave Lochbaum and the Union of Concerned Scientists for many, many years and have great respect for Dave's technical knowledge, his ability to explain things, his careful adherence to good science and good engineering and not advocacy for advocacy's sake. What he says is based on fact, and that as a reporter is what you're looking for. And I have, over the years, an abiding interest in nuclear safety that grew out of my experience with Three Mile Island, and had written, coincidentally, a couple of pieces about nuclear safety at the time of the accident. And so when the Union of Concerned Scientists asked me to team up with Dave and with Ed Lyman, whom I didn't know nearly as well as Dave Lochbaum, I very quickly agreed. It seemed like a good partnership, and what I thought I could bring to this partnership is the ability to tell the story, to put a human face on the accident, to try to convey the intense drama that was unfolding there. This was a technological disaster, but it was also a very compelling human story.
I want to get more into that as we get going here, but first, I've tried to understand Japanese affairs for years. It's almost impossible for an outsider. How were you able to penetrate this strange relationship between the nuclear power operator, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, and the highest levels of the Japanese government?
We did not go to Japan. Ed went to Japan on a related matter, but did not get to Fukushima. But Dave and I were not in Japan, and we don't speak Japanese, so that was another real obstacle. We relied very heavily on documents that were from TEPCO, from the various post-accident investigations in Japan by a variety of committees and commissions. There was a great deal of material that was available in the public record from the United States, from the nuclear industry. So it was a massive research effort through available documents. The language barrier would have been prohibitive even if we had gone to Japan to do interviews, and while in a real ideal world that would have provided a lot of interesting information, we felt from the standpoint of being able to portray the accident and explain what happened, we could rely on public documents and tell the story that way.
Did TEPCO actually go broke because of Fukushima?
TEPCO had to get a bailout from the Japanese government, and let's make that clear, it's the Japanese taxpayers. I have not followed their bottom line recently, but no, I think they've recovered. Now, it's a lot like the United States in that the liability issue is very murky. And I certainly don't understand all of the nuclear liability provision in Japan, but I do think that TEPCO has been protected from the full cost of this accident by regulation and also by the government's willingness to come in and provide financial assistance to keep the company going. The big question is who's going to pay for the staggering cost of the decontamination and the cleanup and the decommissioning. I mean, these are costs that could just skyrocket because no one's ever done this before.
Well, this is something that I think people who object to government debt and higher taxes, I'm thinking perhaps of even the Tea Party, they should really pay attention to these nuclear safety issues because, as far as I understand it, the American people are the insurance company for the nuclear industry. If you have a major accident in the United States, it's the taxpayer who's going to pay for that.
That's right, and we managed to kind of hide the real potential for liability, and I think you can make a case that because of this protection, the industry may not have adhered as much to safety and quality control as it might have. Dave Lockbaum makes an excellent point in that he says that if the owners of nuclear plants had to go out to State Farm or Nationwide and get an insurance policy, in all likelihood they would be a lot more attentive to upgrades and technical details to make the plant safer and safer and safer. But with this government protection under Price-Anderson, they realize that in the case of a severe accident, they are protected, and it's the American taxpayer who's going to foot the bill.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and I'm talking with Susan Stranahan and about her new book, Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. So the other side of this story is all the people who lost their homes, some possibly forever. Can you tell us about the human impact in the area of Fukushima?
Yeah, and I think that that's the one thing that we can't lose sight of. The accident itself was an amazing sequence of heroism. When you think of the fact that many of the workers at Fukushima Daiichi labored for days on end, not knowing what had happened to their families, whether their homes had been destroyed, whether their villages had been washed away by the tsunami, and yet they stayed at their posts trying to wrestle these reactors into some safe condition, and is, sadly, time ran out. The communities around the nuclear plant, we write about how the world watched this accident unfold. We all saw it on our television screens and our cell phones and on our iPads. But because there was no power in this region, the people who were most closely affected and threatened couldn't see what was going on. So they really didn't know what was happening right down the road from them. And they would be relocated outside an evacuation zone with the assurance that they were out of harm's way. And then at some point, someone would come in with radiation detection equipment, and they'd be packed up and bundled off someplace else. So the communities around there had, many of these have been communities, have been, their families have been living there for centuries, and they're no longer able to go back, or may not want to go back because there are no services anymore. There's no assurance that a rainstorm or a forest fire won't recontaminate everything with radiation. One of the sad things that we write about is that there was a plume of radiation that blew to the northwest out about 35 to 40 miles from the plant. And at the time that the U.S. government was recommending that Americans in Japan evacuate out 50 miles from the reactor, the Japanese did not see that that was necessary. And so many people to the northwest of the plant remained in the plume for many, many days before ultimately they were told to leave. And so they were exposed to dangerous levels of radiation that the government just did not either identify or feel the need to move people out in a timely fashion.
And it's also about the kids, of course. They had children cleaning out swimming pools that had radioactive materials in them and cleaning up the landscape. And children now are at risk of leukemia and other health problems. And no doubt they learned a new level of fear that day. Does your new book on Fukushima look into that a bit?
We don't. There are so many aspects. The book could have been 900 pages long if we tried to cover a lot of this. And I think that the health consequences are an issue that that will play out over coming years and is ripe grounds for someone else who may come to this with a public health view. We did not deal with it. We dealt with more of the technical issues of what happened with the reactor, but also with the drama of the people who were trying at that moment to bring this reactor into a safe condition, and they couldn't. So I think there'd be plenty of material for people to go back and do more.
I think there'll be a small library about it and lots of films, I hope, because there are so many angles to it, as you say. Now, look, at both Fukushima and Three Mile Island, the government's first reaction seems to have been to reassure people that everybody's perfectly safe, to downplay the danger. How would you compare the Japanese reaction to what happened after Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania?
Very eerily similar. The reaction at Three Mile Island was initially, we've been told by the company that there's no hazard here, and when in fact at the very moment the lieutenant governor of Pennsylvania was saying that things were under control, the operators at TMI were venting radiation, not on the level of Fukushima, of course, but they were venting. So the initial reaction from both the public officials and the utility and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was to say things are safe, that there's no problem here. And you would certainly think that the 30-some years after Three Mile Island, public officials in Japan and elsewhere would learn that really the thing that people want to hear most is not some calming words, but the truth. And we write in the book that experts who studied Three Mile Island and Chernobyl and now Fukushima all agree on one point, and that is that the public can handle the truth. The public wants the truth, and that if the public isn't given what it believes to be a straight story, then this cycle of fear and distrust begins to just build, and credibility is lost, and people don't know who to trust. And that was true at Three Mile Island. It was true at Fukushima. And it's really sad because at the moment when people are desperate, desperate for information, they just don't trust anybody.
So how would you describe your book, Fukushima, the Story of a Nuclear Disaster? Can you take us through a little bit of how you approached it, how it develops in the book?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. As a storyteller here, what I thought the best way to approach it was what newspaper people call a tick-tock, a minute-by-minute-by-minute account of what happened. and obviously with background and explanation. But what we do is we start with the chandeliers shaking in a hearing room in Tokyo in the Parliament building, and then the events that begin to sweep up. And so we tell this in a chronological fashion. We switch back and forth between what was happening in Japan in the government and at the reactor, and then back at what was happening at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And the point of the including the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is severalfold. Number one, they have a trove of amazing transcripts, chronological calls, emails, just a treasure trove of documents that enabled us to tell the story through the eyes and ears of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And certainly, because it was in English, it helped us tell the story. But these are the people who are charged with protecting Americans. And the point that we made in the book is that this is not a Japanese nuclear accident. This is a nuclear accident that just happened to have occurred in Japan. It could very well have happened in the United States. So here we are telling a story about the best and the brightest of the nuclear safety experts in this country who are really at a loss as to what is happening, how to deal with it, what the ramifications are, how best to respond, what advice to give. So even though the events are 7,000 miles away in Japan, what's going on at the NRC is, we felt, very, very interesting and reflective of just the mindset that prevails in this industry, no matter where it is, that an accident like this couldn't happen, and therefore we don't need to plan for it and have a plan in our back pocket that would deal with an accident. It wouldn't have to be just an earthquake and a tsunami. It could be an earthquake. It could be a flood. It could be a terrorist attack. But there is no plan in place to address the issues that spilled out at Fukushima.
Wow. Well, you know, I'm betting most of our listeners don't know that just 1 year before Fukushima, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission acquired a new building and hired 1,000 more people just to get ready for the promised nuclear renaissance. Where do you think that rebirth of nuclear power stands now after Fukushima?
Well, I think that there are several elements at play here. The availability of cheap natural gas has really changed the balance on energy in this country for a number of years. I do think a concern over climate change and the use of fossil fuels is going to keep nuclear as part of the energy mix. But what we say in this book is that if it is to be an active player in the energy mix, it has to improve its safety record. The public isn't going to accept the status quo. And that we've seen Three Mile Island, we've seen Fukushima. There has to now be pressure put on regulators and reactor owners to eliminate this mindset, get rid of this mindset, and recognize that the unexpected is possible and it has to be planned for. And that's the only way that the public is going to accept an expansion of nuclear power in the energy mix.
Yeah, well, I'm willing to bet there's 1,000 angles to this story that I've missed, and you're a seasoned reporter. Is there anything else that you'd like to tell us about this book or the Fukushima story?
One thing that intrigued me, and this is partly from my Pennsylvania experience and then watching this unfold, is that emergency planning is just inadequate, and that if the public were to focus on an easily understandable issue, they may not be able to go in and argue design and some of the more technical issues involving nuclear safety. But emergency planning is something they can get their head around. They can understand the need to have a clear-cut plan in place that is going to protect them and their families and their properties and their communities. And that seems to me to be where the public might have some leverage that they might not otherwise, if they were raising questions about nuclear safety that were purely a technological issue.
Our guest has been Susan Stranahan, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter on 3 Mile Island and now co-author of one of the first books out of the gate on the Fukushima nuclear catastrophe in Japan. It is called Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. And I can guarantee from speaking to the authors that it's going to be a good and necessary read. Susan, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Oh, I thank you for your time and your interest.
I'm Alex Smith.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
I get email at Radio EcoShock, and it's the best kind. Feedback and ideas from you, the listener. Bobby Wingronowitz from Boston told me he and a whole flock of students from the Boston area were heading to the U.S. Capitol to protest the Keystone XL pipeline. Though he's not an expert audio guy, Bobby took his sound recorder as a witness. Hundreds were arrested. That's a big commitment in the U.S. where your criminal record can become part of your life. It's criminal now to demand a safe climate for young people and the next generation to come. Even some of the nation's top scientists have been arrested. It's not criminal to blow up the climate with a giant pipeline from the notoriously dirty Canadian tar sands. It's all a matter of campaign donations, I guess. When he got back, Bobby wrote to his local paper of record, the Boston Globe. They never published his impassioned letter, so we will.
Being 27 years old, I have never experienced a month with globally average surface temperature below the 20th century mean. The time for meaningful climate legislation was 2 decades ago, but our leaders have failed us. Instead, they have worked with a criminal, doubt-mongering fossil fuel industry to support an all-of-the-above energy non-strategy. On Sunday, March 2nd, 372 of us young people were arrested at the White House to demand leadership on climate. We called our peaceful protest XL Dissent, as we do not consent to the Keystone XL pipeline that would carry 830,000 barrels a day of carbon-intensive, injustice-spewing, semi-viscous, diluted bitumen from a ravaged Alberta to a still-recovering Gulf Coast. That's right, BP. We have not forgotten. We began our action at Georgetown, where last July, President Obama said, "Someday our children and our children's children will look at us in the eye and they'll ask us, did we do all that we could when we had the chance to deal with this problem and leave them a cleaner, safer, more stable world? And I want to be able to say, yes, we did." On Sunday, we told the president he is not doing all he can to deal with the deepening climate crisis. Rejecting Keystone XL, itself only a modest gesture, would signal the president meant what he said. True leadership would include cessation of all new fossil fuel projects, a plan to quickly discontinue coal-fired power plants, and a rising fee on carbon with 100% of the proceeds distributed back to the public. Such leadership would begin to take responsibility on par with our disproportionate culpability for climate change. And it would thus bode well for the strong and binding global deal that we so desperately need at the 2015 Conference of Parties climate meeting in Paris. the polar vortex, and increasing precipitation here in Boston and New England, the ongoing and epic drought in California and the West, year after year of 100-year floods in England, a Winter Olympics with warmer days than the Summer Games, typhoons, hurricanes, and superstorms exacerbated by rising seas and a warmer, moister atmosphere. These and much more forewarn us young people of the uncertain future thrust upon us. From the action on Sunday, to pushing the governor here in Massachusetts on his climate legacy, to trying to remove fossil fuel investments from university endowments, young people increasingly take up the cheer of Native American and First People defenders of the earth and saying, "We are idle no more." President Obama, Secretary Kerry, Governor Patrick, Boston College President Father Leahy, other university presidents, and leaders all around this country and the globe. Talk is cheap. If you do not act swiftly, you give us no choice but to escalate our tactics. On Sunday, we demonstrated our conviction. Our resolve will grow as more of us become aware that we are fighting not just for our own future, but also for the poorest and youngest, whose already imperiled future becomes bleaker the longer we wait.
From Boston, that was Bobby Wengronowitz. After the Keystone XL pipeline protest on March 2nd, they went from Georgetown to the Capitol, where they handcuffed their bodies to the White House fence. Obama, are you listening?
This is what democracy looks like!
It's almost enough to give us hope. Young people know. They care. They have not given up. You can grab some good chance from that march for your own climate protest. If the people of North Africa and the Ukraine can change the government, maybe Americans can boot out the climate deniers and fossil fuel apologists in Congress. Maybe Americans can have a future. I'm Alex Smith. Please support this program at our website, ecoshock.org. or the weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. There are years worth of free MP3 interviews waiting for you there, the voices of scientists, authors, and activists from around the world. Help yourself and help the future with Radio EcoShock.